From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, February the 24th, 2020, and we have a very full show for you today. A whole lineup of guests here. Let me give you a rundown. In the latter hour, we're going to be speaking with Mike Fisher. He is a healthcare advocate with Vermont Legal Aid. He's going to be talking to us about his thoughts on upcoming hearings tomorrow evening in Burlington and Montpelier. I guess Burlington's tomorrow afternoon and then in the evening in Montpelier, relating to a long-standing idea of importing prescription drugs from Canada to try to reduce their costs paid by consumers in this country. A couple of hearings coming up tomorrow. We'll be talking with Mike Fisher about those. He's also got some concerns about the one care, all payer model that Vermont's hospital system has been pushing as a way to realign healthcare spending in the state. And we'll be hearing from Mr. Fisher about all of that. In the mid part of the show, we got a lineup of guests to talk about marijuana legalization, cannabis legalization, if you want to call it that, and commercialization. There's legislation pending in Montpelier which would allow for the establishment of retail shops in Vermont to actually sell cannabis products. And I've been getting a lot of contact from folks who are opposed to this. They're getting quite organized and really banging the drum out there about this being a bad idea. And with us are going to be Dr. Ken Finn. He is a physician in Colorado and has been following closely what the developments in that state with legalization in the last 6 or 8 years. Ann Hassel is a former bud tender. That's someone who, I guess, sells marijuana from Massachusetts. She has soured on the product, shall we say. And Scott Gagner is a member of the Maine State Commission dealing with cannabis legalization and regulation over there. And the three of them are going to be joining me in the second half hour of the program. And then after the top of the hour break and mid-show, we're going to be going with talking with Matt Simon. He's with the Marijuana Policy Project, a longtime advocate for legalization. I want to get both sides of the story here. So we're going to give Matt a chance to respond to some of the concerns raised by the earlier three guests. And but first, we have a visit, a regular Monday morning visit, or at least frequent Monday morning visit, with Colin Mine lined up. He is the managing editor of vtdigger.org and joins us frequently on Mondays to talk about recent Vermont news stories. And Colin, I believe, is on the telephone with us this morning. Good morning, Colin.
Morning, Dave.
Thank you for joining me. Want to check in first? I guess the big story Vermonters are talking about from this weekend is the resounding victory by Bernie Sanders in the Nevada caucuses.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure folks listening are aware of the win, but just really the scale of it was unbelievable. He had over 40% of the votes in Nevada compared to second place finisher, who is former Vice President Joe Biden, who had less than 20. So, I mean, really just he romped in Nevada.
It's interesting. Now, there are you know, I've been reading some of the coverage over the weekend, and of course, there are a lot of moderate, quote unquote, mainstream Democrats, I guess, who are quite worried about Bernie Sanders possibly being the party's standard bearer and nominee going up against President Trump in the general election later this year. And the moderates, of course, are pretty much split up between a range of folks. You got Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, Joe Biden, obviously, former vice president. Mike Bloomberg's going to be getting in as a Super Tuesday. And if they divide up the sort of moderate Democratic vote out there, it does leave Bernie Sanders with a plurality, right?
Yeah, it certainly does. And, you know, in different states, different people are looking good. You know, Pete Buttigieg's really consolidated his resources in Iowa and New Hampshire, and, you know, his campaign sort of benefited from that in a big way with very strong performances in those states. Then you have, you know, Joe Biden, who's very strong in the South. So it's possible that in South Carolina this week and then Super Tuesday that he'll do well. And you know, Mike Bloomberg obviously has had TV blitzes across the country, and perhaps that will show up on Super Tuesday as well. I think one interesting thing to look at is in 2016, there was a lot of criticism of Bernie Sanders for staying in the race as long as he did and fighting Hillary Clinton sort of tooth and nail to the end. And this claim that he sort of damaged her or, you know, sort of prevented the party from consolidating or uniting around a candidate earlier. And you wonder if the moderates who supported Hillary Clinton in that election and were calling on Bernie Sanders to sort of, you know, drop out and support Hillary Clinton will be making the same sort of case if Sanders has a really strong performance in Super Tuesday and is clearly the sort of, you know, the winner. Will they be clamoring for those moderate candidates to drop out and unite around Bernie Sanders?
I doubt it. The, you know, the old shoe on the other foot thing doesn't really work in politics. You know, I think what that question is premised on is an expectation of a lack of hypocrisy. And I haven't noticed much of that in the recent annals of American politics. So, you know, I think the moderates are going to have to figure something out. They if they want to actually challenge Bernie Sanders and keep and block him from getting the nomination, which many of them are desperate to do. They really think that putting Bernie Sanders up against Donald Trump in a general election nationwide is not a formula for success. And they are believing that, you know, their problem is that their votes, their support are too spread around to different people. And they've got to, I mean, it seems like from their perspective, they've got to select one of the people, whether it's Biden or Buttigieg or Klobuchar or whoever, and say, let's rally around this person and see if we can get this. You know, if you add up I haven't actually done the math yet, but I'm pretty sure in New Hampshire, if you added up all of the sort of moderate candidates, they would have easily beaten Bernie Sanders. So there is a moderate majority out there. It's just split up, it seems like. And Bernie Sanders obviously has a strong following. I mean, it, in some ways, it mirrors the 2016 race, doesn't it? In the Republican primary, where you had President Trump with a very strong following himself, and eventually others did peel away and fall away. But it took a while, right?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, that sort of scenario you're just talking about where the moderates sort of fall in line behind one candidate, you wonder if, you know, if that doesn't happen tomorrow, whether it's too late. I mean, if you get through Super Tuesday when you still have this diversity of moderate candidates, then, you know, Bernie Sanders does really strong. Although there was also a national poll out this weekend, I think, maybe today, that showed that Elizabeth Warren has really surged in the second. So, you know, there is another candidate there on the left side of the ticket or the left side of the political spectrum. And, you know, if she does really well, then that might pull some support away from Bernie Sanders as well. You know?
Yeah, that is a possibility. Now, I'm wondering the... I mean, it is interesting to me to see what will end up happening with the Democrats because, I mean, as you told the story of 2016 where the moderates were angry at Sanders for staying in as long as he did. If Bernie Sanders appears to be heading for the nomination and then is somehow denied it, and it's hard to define exactly what that is. Does that mean he has a plurality of delegates, but a clear plurality, or would he need to have a majority of delegates really to stake a claim on the nomination going into the convention? Imagine for a moment, though, that the Democrats figure out a way to block him, you know, assuming he has, say, in a 40% range plurality support among delegates, but they still figure out somehow, you know, a brokered convention that would block him from getting the nomination. I'm just wondering, to what degree would that be just really, really damaging to the long-term and certainly short-term prospects of the Democrats? I mean, if any Bernie people stayed home last time, boy, it would seem that this time they'd be really fed up.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have people basically refusing to participate in the political system both this year and for years out and, you know, trying to come up with other ways to sort of make their voices heard, whether that's, you know, closing down buildings or other sort of, you know, civil unrest. I mean, it's hard to imagine people who are sort of this dedicated to the cause and this sort of committed to, you know, having their voice heard would just go quiet because, you know, somehow the Democratic establishment was able to move behind another candidate.
Yeah, and you know, let's recall back to 2016. It was a couple of weeks before the Democratic convention when Bernie Sanders conceded and went to a joint appearance with Hillary Clinton in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and you know threw his support behind her and urged his supporters to do the same, and then appeared at quite a number of Clinton events throughout the general election period, and. I mean, he definitely played ball to a much greater extent than, say, John Kasich did for Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that unless basically that description or, you know, that scenario that you said, which is that, at the convention, the sort of Democratic power players somehow, work out a deal to unfairly, or in his view, unfairly prevent him from getting the nomination, then, it's hard to imagine him sort of swallowing that and then heading out on the trail for whoever it is that is the candidate. I think part of his thinking in that case was that Hillary Clinton won fair and square and that it was his duty to get behind the Democratic candidate. Obviously, she's come out, on the trail, she was very thankful of him and sort of around the election saying that Bernie Sanders, worked his butt off for her. Since then, she has come out with a fairly different opinion, saying that she blames him in part for Donald Trump becoming president. But we'll see.
Yeah, that performance by Clinton, that post-election performance that she has put on, has really not been helpful to anybody. And I don't even really think to her, it makes her look like a sore loser. And frankly, maybe there's a reason for that. I don't know. I mean, it's left a bad taste, I think, in a lot of people's mouths to watch Hillary Clinton bashing Bernie Sanders, who actually, when you compare her and him, that primary contest to many, many others, it was a pretty kid glove affair. You got up at that debate way back in October of 15 and talked about how the American people don't care about your emails and so on. And I mean, other primary rivals would have used an issue like that as an absolute cudgel, and here he was just saying, "I don't want to talk about that, and nobody cares, and et cetera."
I think there's like an irony almost, and people talk about there's been a lot of talk recently about the Bernie Bros online and their negativity, and Pete Buttigieg's sort of line against Bernie has been that from the top down the campaign is very sort of negative and aggressive. But really, Bernie Sanders is not one to lob personal attacks on people or to sort of go after their motivations and that kind of thing. I mean, he talks a lot about billionaire donors, of course, and the sort of corrupting influence of them on his competitors, but otherwise is largely talking about his policies. It's a very sort of assertive campaign in what he would do rather than trying to go after other folks.
And Colin, a very interesting story and kind of disturbing a little bit, I think, especially for small town residents in Vermont, has to do with the U.S. Census this morning. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, this is from our data reporter, Aaron Petanko. The New York Times had a story about how the census, that is the bureau of the federal government that oversees census each year, in an effort to sort of ensure the privacy of people in sparsely populated areas, was going to do what sort of data nerds call introduce noise to the data, which is put in some sort of false numbers to cloud some of the data in very sparsely populated places. The idea being that if you have the correct numbers, you can sort of compare those against other publicly available databases to identify people and sort of see their answers to some of the questions on the census. And of course, the census promises that your answers to the survey will be completely confidential and will be anonymous. Well, not anonymous internally, but will not be available to the public. But the sort of the result of this is that for very small places, some of the numbers are going to be wrong. And Aaron ran the data and found out that there could be up to a 10% sort of miscalculation, or that the inflation or deflation of the population in small Vermont towns could be up to 10%. And the result of that is that it could result in less federal funding. There's something like $2.5 billion that Vermont has at stake from the federal government. Depending on the results of the next census, it could also mess up electoral districts. So, you know, some pretty big consequences. And the census says that it's trying to balance these two things between sort of privacy and accuracy. They didn't give us a whole lot of information for how they're reckoning with this, but they said the discussion is continuing and they're listening to feedback.
Interesting. Now, is it, are they saying anything about trying not only to balance privacy versus accuracy, I guess, is the best way maybe to describe the situation. But if you're going to fudge the numbers, it seems like there could be, just all other things being equal, you know, kind of an equal likelihood that you fudge on the upside versus the downside, if you see what I mean. Is there any discussion of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true.
And I mean, could the two average out so that Vermont isn't really hurt by this practice? Could this practice be designed to kind of hold a state like Vermont harmless?
Well, they could average out across the state, but that doesn't change the fact that in certain concentrations, the sort of amount of federal funding is going to be increased or decreased. I mean, Federal funding is not only dispersed to a state, it can also be dispersed to certain areas. The census is used to identify sort of parts of you know, different states that need targeted sort of programming and funding and that sort of thing. So even if in aggregate across the state, the numbers turn out about right, and indeed in places like Burlington, this will really have a negligible effect because of the size of the population. It's really those small towns and whether or not they might see some sort of decrease in funding or missed opportunities because of this.
This kind of thing where it comes up, it's not infrequent in Vermont to have data crunchers try to come in and get an accurate picture of something that's going on in the state. And the problem is that people are too easily identified. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago when I was still working for the Associated Press, I was looking into what the ACLU was describing as the school to prison pipeline. And part of the story was a discussion about a fear and maybe an actuality that students of color are disciplined more frequently in our schools and to a more severe degree than our white students. But if you started actually trying to crunch the numbers and figure that out, you'd go to a school district, you know, some rural school district in Vermont, and it turns out there's only one or two students of color in the whole district. You know, that would basically shoot any privacy, you know, out of the sky, right? And so they were very reluctant to provide any data at all, and they cited that privacy issue. And, you know, as a reporter, obviously you always want maximum access to the data, but on the other hand, you know, I could sort of see why, frankly.
Yeah, that's right. And the same thing goes for testing results that, you know, when you're trying to compare sort of, you know, students of color with other students or low-income students, that when you have these towns that have, like, you know, 10 students in a grade or something like that, that when you start to sort of segment out different parts of that population, then you end up with one or two people in different groups. And then you can see basically the test scores of individual students, which is something that the Agency of Education avoids or isn't allowed to do. So,
yep.
You know, when you get to these small towns, anything to do with the data, whether it's sort of trying to make sense of how different populations are acting, or in the case of the census here, you know, trying to say this percentage of the population is impoverished or that kind of thing, then you end up with just a handful of people. So adding a few here or there or taking away a few here and there can have a real impact.
And then, of course, things continue to churn along at the Vermont State House, where I guess there's going to be a vote up in the House tomorrow on the minimum wage increase that the governor vetoed. And there must be a vote upcoming, and I've lost track, but maybe you can fill me in, Colin, on the proposal to legalize cannabis and commercialize it in the state. Minimum wage vote very close tomorrow, right?
Yeah, and we have heard, you know, there's been some commitment from leadership in the House to have that vote. I think it's very much within the realm of possibility that they would push it back further. They've talked about attendance issues and that kind of thing. So, you know, certainly it's not beyond House leadership if they're not confident in the result of the vote to come up with a reason to delay it. It is going to be super close, and based on our reporting, they're still a bit short. They've flipped perhaps a few people, but they needed to flip something like four or five, and we can count two or three so far. So it would be quite an egg on the face of the Democratic leadership of the House if they failed another override vote on minimum wage and basically had to concede that they're going to walk away from the session without paid family leave or minimum wage heading into an election year. I think that would be a pretty tough pill to swallow. But there are some other interesting things going on, like you said, especially on climate change. The House passed the Global Warming Solutions Act, which is a pretty interesting piece of legislation. It's been tested out in Massachusetts and some other places. It's still very early days in those other states as well. But the idea is that you take the goals that you want the state to meet for things like climate for like emissions reductions and put those into statute and then have the opportunity for citizens to bring lawsuits against the government if it is unsuccessful in meeting some of those goals. Those lawsuits would not result in monetary damages, but would rather allow the court to impose certain actions or to order the state government to go back to the drawing board and figure out how to actually meet its reduction targets. And then, like you mentioned, the Senate Natural Resources Committee right now is getting to work on a constitutional amendment that would enshrine the right to clean air and clean water into the Constitution, so that becomes a guarantee if the federal government, for example, is not doing what it needs to do to ensure that people, Vermonters in particular, have a right to clean air and clean water, then the state's constitution would mandate that the state ensure those protections.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. It really opens up a lot of questions about what would that mean about the ability, for instance, to for citizens to bring lawsuits. The state is violating its own constitution by not doing enough to ensure clean water, clean air, and so on. This is kind of a new concept, I think, to a lot of people, and I'm wondering if is that going to pass all stages this year? Is it going to get through and be done with this biennium, and then of course it would have to be voted on again in the next biennium?
Yeah. So the Senate leader Tim Ash seems pretty skeptical about this right to a clean environment constitutional amendment. He said, he wouldn't really count it out, but he said, conversations are having. We'll see what we have time to do this session. So this kind of stuff you hear from leadership when they don't intend to accelerate a bill.
Yeah.
And it is a pretty big idea, and it's just getting started in a committee now. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if that sort of ends up getting shelved until the next biennium. I think it's probably an idea that can get traction, and I'm getting played off here. So I'll leave it at that.
Colin Ryan of etdigger.org, I thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's always good chatting with you, and let's do it again soon.
Yes, sir. Bye.
All righty. We are going to go to some bottom-of-the-hour news from CBS on the Dave Graham Show. When we return, we're going to be talking to some folks about their concerns with the idea in Vermont of commercial sales of cannabis, marijuana. And we'll see what comes around the bend on that discussion in a little bit. We'll be back, folks. Stay with us.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Continuing into the second half hour of this Monday morning program on the Dave Graham Show, I wanted to turn our attention now to the question of whether Vermont should not only legalize cannabis, but allow it to be sold in stores, a la Massachusetts, Colorado, a few other states that are doing this. And I've got a lineup of folks on the show this morning with me in the next half hour or so, I think, who are all very skeptical of this idea. Joining me so far, Dr. Ken Finn. He is a pain specialist at a clinic in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Of course, Colorado is one of the states that has sort of been I don't know, a poster child or something for this issue since they legalized marijuana in 2012. Also on the line with us, Scott Gagner. He is with the State Marijuana Commission over in Maine, and Maine is just on the cusp of starting retail sales. They legalized a couple of years ago and have been in a rulemaking process since then. Expected, I'm understanding that maybe the first retail shops selling cannabis products could be open as soon as this spring over in Maine. And so Dr. Ken Finn and Scott Gagner, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And let me start with you, Dr. Finn, because your state has, of the people we're talking to this morning, I guess the most experience in this area. And I know I spoke with you on Friday briefly, and we got to the – I quickly reached a conclusion. You have a lot of concerns with how things have unfolded in Colorado. Give me your top two or three issues there.
The top two or three issues is public health and safety, adolescent use, and driving impairment, and marijuana-related driving fatalities.
And you cited quite a few statistics and so on when we talked on Friday. Give me a recap here.
Well, obviously there's a lot to cover in a very short period of time. However, based on the SAMHSA, or Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration data most recently, obviously Vermont leads the country in adolescent use ages 12 to 17, young adult use is 18 to 25, and is second in the nation in adult use of 26 years of age and older. Maine is number two in the adolescent and young adult category, and number six in the adult category, and then Colorado is still in the top 10 at number seven for youth use, number three for young adult use, and fourth for adult use.
So use is actually higher in Vermont than it is in Colorado, even though retail sales are allowed in Colorado, and they are not in Vermont?
Correct.
That is that's surprising, frankly. I would think that where access was going to be easier vis-a-vis retail sales, you could just walk into a shop, I guess, and buy some of these products you'd see higher use, frankly, in a state like that than in a state where, Vermont has a strange hybrid law right now where we legalized as of July of 2018 possession of up to an ounce by people 21 and older. And you can also have a small number of plants to grow your own. But we don't allow currently the sale in stores of cannabis products. I'm a little bit dumbfounded, frankly, by the idea that a state where stores are allowed to sell cannabis would have lower use rates than Vermont, and the Vermont use rates are based on SAMHSA data.
SAMHSA data, yeah. And the problem with the home grows is, that's just a breeding ground for the black market, because the black market is thrived in Colorado and other states that have legalized, like California. It did not go away like we were promised by the ballot measure and those pushing for the ballot. The black market is alive and well in Colorado.
Scott Gagner in Maine, are you that was a ballot measure there too that brought about legalization of cannabis, is that right?
2016 we had a vote along with Massachusetts and a few other states. It very narrowly passed. It was actually less than 4,000 votes between yes and no. In fact, more people didn't vote on the initiative than that gap in between. It was legalized, but it's been in sort of a legislative process since then. So we haven't quite gone full commercialization yet, although frankly, Maine has one of the most liberal medical marijuana programs in the country, where we just eliminated the condition list. So really the barrier to get a card to get medical marijuana is pretty low, and essentially really is a de facto adult use commercialization before we have sort of the regular stores open up. So so access is pretty easy in Maine, and so us being at number two in the nation isn't really all that surprising to me.
In terms of you being number two in terms of use by young people in their teens or early 20s?
Yeah, and young adults, because, I mean, especially young adults, because they have, you know, just once you turn 21, they have full access to the medical program. Actually, minors can have access to the medical program as well, but frankly, I think it's a factor of the campaigns that have been a nonstop in Maine since 2013. So we know from prevention research that normalization of substances has a big impact on youth. Using substances, and you know, since 2013, the state's been saturated with messages from the marijuana industry. So it's really not surprising at all that we're as high as we are.
What was the prevalence of use among youth, say, 10 years ago, before this all of this advertising started in Maine?
Well, it was actually lower. I mean, 10 years ago, marijuana was on the same pathway that our underage drinking rates were, our underage tobacco rates. Everything was trending down. It was in good space. And then once the campaigning started happening, I mean, 2009 is when we passed the law to allow for medical marijuana dispensaries and medical marijuana caregivers. And really, since then, you know, it flattened out for a while everything else still trended down. And now we're starting to see it increase. In 2019, we're seeing our first statistically significant increase on underage 12 to 17, 30-day use of marijuana. And again, that doesn't surprise me either because of the nonstop, really saturation of messaging around legalization. And so I think we're starting to see the fallout of that amongst our young people and our young adults.
I'm trying to remember, in Maine, the rules around alcohol are different than they are in Vermont. I think you can walk into like a regular supermarket in Maine and buy a bottle of liquor. Is that right?
That's correct. The liquor stores can be, they can be pharmacies, they can be regular grocery stores. So there's pretty, so it can be common in a lot of those different places.
And in Vermont, of course, we have these specially designated retail outlets, which are privately owned, but are very closely held by the state. In fact, the state is the wholesaler for alcohol. For spirituous alcohol anyway, for liquor, and then in New Hampshire you have integrated industry retail to wholesale. It's all state operated. So I mean, it's interesting the different styles of kind of sale of this other drug, addictive substance that alcohol is. And what's the case in Colorado, Dr. Ken Finn? What with alcohol?
Well, if you look at the data regarding the amount of revenue generated with alcohol from the Department of Revenue in Colorado, you know, coinciding with commercialization and legalization, the amount of gallons consumed since 2012 has gone up significantly. So, you know, it really isn't an issue of whether or not someone's going to go home and replace their glass of wine with a joint. It looks like Colorado continues to enjoy lots of substances, including methamphetamine, heroin, and alcohol.
Now, in the case of, I was more about asking about the kind of current regulatory regime. Are they state-operated stores in Colorado, or is it sold in supermarkets? Or if somebody wants to go out and buy a bottle of, you know, gin or something, What are they dealing with in Colorado?
You know, we have both medical marijuana dispensaries, which are taxed at a lower rate than the recreational marijuana dispensaries, which are taxed at a higher rate. And the products really are no different. However, when Colorado voted on legalization of marijuana, over 70% of the municipalities didn't want it in their community, and that's been the same story in California and Michigan, for example, where 80% of the communities opted out of having commercialized marijuana in their backyard, even though they went by the vote of the people. And if you look at Detroit, the city of Detroit, you'd be surprised, opted out of having recreational marijuana. But, you know, they had almost a murder every day in in Detroit in the first month of this year. And most of those homicides were related to marijuana dispensary burglaries.
Marijuana dispensary burglaries in Detroit.
In Detroit.
We also have on the phone with us Ann Hassel. Ann is from Massachusetts and has some experience working in the retail marijuana industry. Good morning, Ann. Ann Hassel, are you with us? Does not sound like she is. Oh, well. Scott Gagner, your chief concerns in Maine with proceeding, I mean, as of later this year, you're probably going to see, it sounds like, retail shops where people are going to go in and buy cannabis products in Portland and maybe in Booth Bay and other towns in your state. And I'm just wondering... Your fears about it really are what?
I mean, there's quite a few. I mean, you know, when we talk about alcohol, I mean, that's often the phrase that we heard is we want to regulate marijuana like alcohol. The problem is we haven't done a very good job of that. What was interesting, actually, before legalization, our underage drinking rates were actually higher than our 12 to 17 marijuana use. So we're using alcohol as sort of the gold standard. I'm afraid we set the bar a little low, but beyond that, I mean, with the prevention research, we know there's a lot of risk factors that contribute to young people likely using substances, and normalization is one of them. So, you know, as stores open up in communities, that sets, that's a message in that community that says this is important. And so that has an effect. Advertising. I think, you know, because of our First Amendment, it's going to be really challenging for any state, Maine, Vermont, that's regulating this product or attempting to regulate this product to really be able to put any kind of meaningful parameters around advertising doesn't appeal to young people. So, I mean, Maine put in their rules that advertising can't appeal to young people, but it's going to be challenging because we've seen in other states, you know, that those regulations can often get challenge in courts, and you know they'll claim that it's not promoting to young people when it clearly is. So it's just that's going to be a challenge. And then, frankly, I just don't think, and the track record's not good really for any state to do a very good job of regulating this product in terms of safety and youth access and young adult access. You know, most states have failed on every measure when we're looking at public safety, you know, whether it's the impaired driving issues. This vaping lung injury outbreak is another good example of how states have really not been able to adequately regulate for safety. You know, the CDC data is pretty clear that 1 in 6 of the vaping devices that are causing lung injury are state-regulated, state-sanctioned products. So that's been a failure. And then, frankly, you know, social justice often comes up. And I think commercialization is going to contribute to greater health disparities. It's not going to reduce them because we know from alcohol and tobacco research that the outlet density is always greatest in our poor and vulnerable population neighborhoods. I don't expect marijuana to be any different, where it's not going to be located in rich, wealthy neighborhoods. It's going to be in the poor neighborhoods. And, you know, the track record's not good with alcohol and tobacco as far as the public health outcomes. The negative public health outcomes are inordinately bared by our vulnerable population. So,
I had a guest on a couple of weeks ago who was talking about menthol cigarettes and saying that menthol tobacco products tend to be very, very heavily advertised in communities of color, and that use is actually higher in communities of color, et cetera. Bad health effects as an outcome. Are you talking about a similar dynamic here?
I mean, that could be part of it. Part of it could be flavoring, but also, like I said, just the density, the outlet density.
Yeah.
Because we've seen that with alcohol, that there's more dispensaries located densely in poor and minority neighborhoods. And then the research, you know, the public health data backs it up, that there's greater negative public health outcomes borne by those populations. And I mean, I know, I think in Colorado and I think other states, we're already starting to see that pattern with marijuana dispensaries where they're more densely located in poor neighborhoods.
They're not located next to the governor's house, that's for sure.
Dr. Ken Finn, I heard as of yesterday you needed to duck out at about 9:50, which it is right now, or 7:50 your time. You're in Colorado. Is that true?
I got a few more minutes.
Okay.
You need have any other questions for me?
One more. So your bottom line recommendation to the state of Vermont is what?
Proceed with caution.
All right, Dr. Ken Finn, I appreciate you joining me this morning. We do need to go to a brief break on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, and I thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Dave. I appreciate the opportunity. If you need any more information, I could be here as a resource for you.
Okay, great. Thanks again. Scott, what is the official name of the commission there in Maine?
It's the Maine Marijuana Advisory Commission.
The Maine Marijuana Advisory Commission, which it sounds like is the organization set up in the state law to actually oversee the introduction of retail sales of marijuana in Maine. How am I doing so far?
It's really more of an advisory commission. It's not quite like Massachusetts, which actually has the commission actually has some regulatory control. Unfortunately, our commission is more advisory, so we don't really have that same level of oversight, but that is our role, is to provide advice around the rollout of regulation.
I see. Okay, and I believe Ann Hassel is on the line with us from Western Massachusetts. Is that right?
Yes, I am, David.
Good morning, Ann, and how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Thank you very much for joining us. I'm well. I wanted to check in with you and just find out a little bit about your story. We met on Friday at the State House, and you were telling me that you are a former bud tender. Is that right?
That's right, David. I worked as a bud tender for a year and a half in a Massachusetts marijuana dispensary. My boss told me to sell moldy marijuana to sick elderly ladies. In order to mask the mold to pass lab testing, moldy marijuana was dunked into barrels of caustic hydrogen peroxide, so caustic that it burnt the workers' arms. This was my corporation's policy, profit over health. And, David, I had to go along with it because I would have been targeted and fired. As you know, I've been in Vermont the past month speaking out and warning the public because I am very worried for the people of Vermont.
Let me stop you there for a second. Ask you, it seems like with any product, if someone were selling a product in, let's just say it were, I don't know, bread from a local bakery, and it had been it had developed mold, and somebody had dipped it in some chemical that was very unhealthful, and so on, and they put it on the shelves for sale. Wouldn't there be some kind of a procedure, a regulatory procedure in the state to have the state health department come down and shut that bakery down?
Well, actually, I did contact the Department of Public Health Medical Marijuana Program in charge of regulating this because my management knew about this. This is known in the industry about the mold. Nothing was done and I was ignored. But it's one heck of a big red flag that the Vermont Commercialization Bill will have marijuana corporations testing their own products. That was mentioned today in the Vermont Digger in a commentary urging Vermonters to contact their legislators and vote no, because you're having the foxes in charge of the hen house. And that, as you know, is very, very bad decisions, because they will do anything to make money. And they don't care if they're harming people, because, David, they can get away with it. It's happened not just in Massachusetts, but in Colorado, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Vermont. The Vermont Digger did a report in December 2018 where mold was a known problem in the dispensary. The workers approached management. Nothing was done. And those workers were too afraid to come forward publicly. They remained anonymous in the article. They were afraid. Their non-disclosure agreements. And I was at one time too afraid. But something needs to be done, because it's not right to harm people for profit.
All right. Well, we are... unfortunately, fast approaching the top of the hour and about out of time for this segment on the Dave Graham Show. I want to thank my guests very much. First, Dr. Ken Finn, who had to duck out a little early. Scott Gagner of the Maine Marijuana Advisory Commission. And Ann Hassel, a former bud tender from Massachusetts. Thank you, the three of you, for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having us.
All righty, we're going to go to some CBS News here at the top of the hour on the Dave Graham Show. Be back with more of the program afterwards. Stay with us, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. palms and beanies galore, and a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont, the almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And while we were mentioning the Warren Store, we want to mention that they are very kindly sponsoring our podcast of the Dave Graham Show here on the website of WDEV FM and AM. Just go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link from the homepage there to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit and you will find a list of our recent programs by topic and by guest. And you'll be able to listen at any time of day or night to your heart's content. Can't call us at between 2 and 4 in the morning, but you can certainly listen and get caught up with what we've been talking about on our air here. In fact, the last half hour or so, we were talking about the concerns of some folks who are upset with the prospect of Vermont legalizing, not just legalizing, but commercializing, going to retail sales of cannabis products. And We like to get both sides of the story, or even more than two sides of the story, on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And I wanted to bring in another voice here for the next little bit on the show here. Matt Simon is with the Marijuana Policy Project. He has been lobbying off and on at the State House. I think he's based over in New Hampshire, but he comes up to Montpelier quite often and sits in on legislative testimony and testifies himself in the hallowed halls of Montpelier about the prospect of bringing legalized marijuana use to the state of Vermont. Matt is on the phone with me this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me. And did you have a chance to listen for the last little bit of the program there before the mid-show break?
Yes, I did, and I took some notes. And if you don't mind, I'd like to start by addressing something your guest from Massachusetts said. I imagine if any patients are listening to this, or really anybody, they'd be horrified if they believed that S-54 doesn't require independent lab testing of cannabis. And it's absolutely a cornerstone of the bill that it does, for the first time, bring independent lab testing to Vermont. The status quo is that the dispensaries test their own products, and that's the situation now. But it's certainly in S-54. A lot of people are confused by this because a retail store can get a testing license, but there's a provision that makes it absolutely clear you have to have your cannabis independently tested by a lab that is not yours. And that's one of, the basics here. We're trying to regulate this product in an effective way and not in a ridiculous way, as the guest suggested.
And the Who actually are there independent labs already established, or would they have to be set up in order to do this testing?
There are already a couple of independent labs that I understand are they have other purposes than testing cannabis, but they are willing to test people's cannabis now. But that would be somebody choosing to bring their cannabis in that wants to know what's in it and paying a substantial fee. What we want is for the supply chain, which is currently, entirely controlled by illicit market actors and subjected to no testing. There's a lot of moldy cannabis on the illicit market. There's a lot of heavy metals and pesticides in the illicit market supply chain. And if we're really concerned about public health and we acknowledge that cannabis use is widespread in Vermont, which it is, having it tested by independent labs is key. So the bill would allow existing labs to apply for licenses as testing labs. It would allow the dispensaries or a grower, anybody can have up to one of each license type. But that important clarification that if you have a testing lab, it's for testing cannabis that's going to be sold by somebody other than you, that needs to be independently tested.
Okay, So that concern, do you have any sense of whether the story that she told about what was going on in Massachusetts with what sounds like some fairly unscrupulous actors in the industry, is there any truth to that? Have you seen news reports on that or anything?
It's horrifying to hear that, and we hear complaints from patients. So Massachusetts, when they passed the medical cannabis law, they did a terrible job of implementing it, and it was overseen by the Department of Public Health, which really did a bad job for the first couple years of it. It's now since been rolled, all of medical cannabis has been rolled into the Cannabis Control Commission, which also regulates adult use cannabis. And I think they're doing a much better job now. I haven't heard those sorts of complaints, but certainly the risk exists. It exists now in the illicit market that we have, that it's, you know, sometimes you can help your bottom line by cheating in a way that would harm consumers by using pesticides to make sure you maximize your product, the amount you're able to grow, and things like that. Or if you do grow moldy weed, there are ways, as you heard, of treating it. But that should not be happening in a regulated market. And if it is, the solution is to improve the regulations and the oversight, not to just say, fine, let's just let gangs, cartels, and whoever they want grow and sell cannabis, which seems to be what they're suggesting. And I just don't understand how that's responsible from a public health perspective.
Well, I think that is a question for me, which is that if you look at the current situation, kind of the current regime with marijuana sales in Vermont, as you said, it is largely a function of an illicit industry, which is not really gained any kind of a foothold in the state, because trafficking in anything larger than an ounce of marijuana is still illegal in Vermont. And so anybody who's going to be shipping enough marijuana to some location where, you know, you could actually go and buy your ounce of marijuana and possession of an ounce is legal. I mean, that's one of the things that doesn't really make sense to me about the current situation, is that it would be as if, you know, there was some question about the legality of milk, and you could legally buy, you could legally actually possess milk in Vermont. You just couldn't have farms, and you couldn't have you couldn't have dairy co-ops, and you couldn't have any of the retailers selling milk. Am I on the right track there, or is that kind of crazy?
Well, it certainly seems to make sense to me that for any consumer product, I mean, unless we believe that prohibition is going to start working tomorrow, that people en masse are just going to stop using cannabis cold turkey for whatever reason, if people are going to continue using cannabis at high rates as they do in Vermont and across the United States, we have a responsibility to make sure that they're not ingesting toxins and poisons when we know that that's preventable. So independent lab testing is just critical. It's key to the bill, and it's one of the really important reasons to not have this. And your other guest mentioned the vaping outbreak. Look at the CDC's map of where the biggest vaping problems were. It's entirely, almost entirely, in states where cannabis is not legal and is not regulated. I don't believe they've had a death yet in Colorado. I could be wrong about that. I haven't heard about a single one. And next door in Utah, where all sales are unregulated and prohibited, they've had quite a few deaths. So it just speaks to the need to clean up the supply chain and regulate this commonly consumed consumer product.
Now, one of the things that one of the worries being raised by, particularly by Dr. Finn, the gentleman from Colorado who was on the phone with me earlier, he was saying that, Scott Gagnier from Maine touched on this as well. In Mr. Gagnier's case, he was talking about the normalization of marijuana that comes with not just legalization, but retail sales and potentially advertising and so on. And that you end up with higher rates of use by young people. Are those stats borne out from what you know?
Well, I would say absolutely not. I'm surprised that people are still actually using those talking points. I mean, one could argue that cannabis use has become much less stigmatized over the last decade or so. And yet, over that period of time, national use by teens has actually gone down somewhat. It was the National Survey on Drug Use and Health in 2012 and 13 said that it was 7.2% of 12 to 17-year-olds using cannabis. And in the last survey, it was down to 6.6%, so about a half-point decline over the last 8 years nationally. in states with regulated markets, Colorado being a perfect example, was the biggest fear there was that teen use would go up. Well, they had the highest teen use in the country back in 2012 when they legalized. It was 11.2%. It was 12% the next year, and now it's 9.4%. And people seem to be surprised by that, but from my perspective, it just makes a lot of sense that you have a regulated market now. They sold $1.75 billion with a B dollars worth of cannabis last year in Colorado in that regulated market. And everybody that was buying that cannabis had to show an ID. They had to show an ID to get into the store. They had to show another ID when they purchased the product. And there's no magical system that's going to prevent teenagers from getting cannabis if they really, really want it. But creating that regulated market has at least put up a substantial barrier, and it's produced quite a lot of tax revenue, much of which has been spent on education programs and on prevention and on encouraging responsible use. And it seems to be working pretty well. As we heard, Colorado's down to number 7th in the country in teen use, and now Vermont and Maine are number 1. Well, what do Vermont and Maine have in common? They're states that have legalized cannabis but have zero functional regulations. In Maine, because the previous governor refused to implement the will of voters and they're just now getting around to doing it, and in Vermont because we haven't gotten a law passed yet that would regulate the industry. But I think most rational people, when they see states that have zero regulations are number 1 and number 2, and states with regulated markets are actually having success, what are we waiting for? And how is that a public health perspective to say we should leave this all to illicit market actors who don't check IDs and who might sell, you know, toxic cannabis and toxic other substances?
I wonder also whether you see that if Maine and Vermont are number 1 and 2 or something like that on teen use and the current status here. I mean, I suppose an anti-marijuana person might argue we should go back and reestablish making possession of small amounts up to an ounce currently legal in Vermont, make them illegal again. What would you say to an argument like that?
Well, prohibition wasn't an effective deterrent at any point. And if we really care about protecting young people, we need to try to minimize the harms. And that's done through a regulated system. That's done through education and smart regulations and trying to restrict access and trying to make sure kids have access to the best information. And, you know, it used to be the case that you could just scare kids and crack an egg in a skillet and say, this is your brain on drugs. And that might work, but today kids have the internet. If you tell them that cannabis is as dangerous as heroin or whatever, they're going to Google it and find out that you're wrong within a matter of seconds. It's objectively less harmful than alcohol. That doesn't mean it's harmless. It means that it is responsible for a lot less damage, both to individuals and to society, than to alcohol. And the question is, how do we minimize that harm and that damage? And it seems really clear that leaving a lucrative tens of billions dollar market to a completely unregulated illegal system is not the way to do that.
Well, one of the concerns raised by the critics of this idea is that the marijuana that's being marketed today is significantly stronger, I guess, higher THC content than that marketed, you know, when a lot of folks who may remember smoking some pot back in college were doing so, and that it's a more dangerous substance today than it was 40 years ago. What do you say to all that?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that average potency has increased, and that happened while cannabis was illegal. It's not something that happened because of legalization. But the question is, how much does that actually matter? And, you know, again, from a health perspective, having somebody smoke an entire joint of very low THC cannabis to achieve the same effect of smoking less of a more potent product, it's, there's a downside to a lower potency product. But really what's most important is that people who are consumers be able to make informed choices. When you walk into a brewery and you order a beer in Vermont, you know whether it's 4.5% alcohol or 9.5% alcohol or 7% alcohol. It's tested, it's labeled, and you're able to titrate your dose accordingly. with cannabis, when you buy a bag of cannabis on the illicit market, it could be 5% THC, it could be 25% THC, and of course it could have pesticides, heavy metals, molds, and all that sort of thing on it as well. When you walk into a retail store, which incidentally there are now three of those within 15 miles of Vermont's southern border, so everybody does have access to a regulated cannabis market. Now, if they're willing to just leave the state by a few miles, and you'll see that every product that they sell is tested and is labeled for purity and potency. So somebody who wants a lower potency product can get it. Somebody who wants the most potency they can achieve can buy that. And incidentally, there are potency limits in the Vermont bill. In the House version of S-54, in response to some of these concerns, they did add some limits in, which we're not crazy about, but if that's what it takes to get this plant out of the shadows and into a regulated system, we're willing to make those compromises.
Is that practical? I mean, can you actually make a marijuana product and calibrate the dose downward?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's substantial demand for a lot of those products. As you said, somebody who hasn't tried cannabis in a couple of decades is not going to be looking to see how stoned they can get. They're going to look for a lower THC product and hopefully have a informed employee behind the counter who can steer them towards that sort of product. But if somebody's a daily consumer, it's kind of crazy to, you know, expect them to use a low potency product all the time. They're just going to seek more potent products from the illicit, unregulated market.
Let me bring in a couple. We have a couple listeners that we're calling in now. And let's go to Catherine in Burlington. Good morning, Catherine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to address some of the points that Matt Simon brought up. I'm appalled and really concerned that he's putting out information that's patently incorrect. We have information that the youth use rate in Colorado has gone up remarkably, and it's really unhelpful that he continues to
disassemble. Care to share the source of that?
For example, we have information from teen ER visits in Colorado are up 71%. We know that youth use has increased 25% in states with legal commercialized recreational marijuana.
Again, please cite your source, doctor. That's garbage.
That's from JAMA Psychiatry, 2019. And the other was from the Adolescent Emergency and Urgent Care Visits, Journal of Adolescent Health, 2018. And we have, you know, article after article after article. There was a preliminary article years ago that showed states that had medical marijuana had some decrease in opiate use. That study was repeated in the last year, and it showed the opposite results. And yet we're getting, you know, the media reporting on the old studies but not on the new studies. This thing about the it being safer when it's commercialized, this is false. We have almost 80% of marijuana that's sold in Denver shops has mold in it. Just last year, we have very high THC rates. And we have, you know, we have workers even in Vermont that are saying we're told to sell moldy marijuana when it's reported. We're not seeing consequences. If our state isn't able to,
we don't have independent
have some
lab
sort of consequence,
testing in Vermont, doctor.
And if David Graham isn't, you know, able to interview these folks with their names out in the open, the way
why don't you support independent lab testing if you don't want moldy cannabis?
The independent lab testing is a ruse. We see that supposedly in other states. It doesn't happen in California, in Oregon, which is one that the Vermont people like to talk about a lot. Only 3% of the product that's
okay
for sale in shops in Oregon has actually been tested.
Catherine, I'm going to jump in here and suggest that, you know, we did give your side of this question a full half hour earlier in the show today, so I want to jump to get another caller in here, actually, so I'm going to jump and thank you for the call, though.
Thank you.
Let's go to Forbes in Corinth.
Three questions. Number one, DUI, of course. How are we dealing with that? and business and industry, how they're going to cope with that is hard. You can smell alcohol from 3 feet away, but how are they going to deal with it? And third, doctor so-and-so, teacher so-and-so, and legislator so-and-so, are we going to see them going in and out of a dispensary, or are they still going to get their supply from the normal places they always have?
Well, let's go to at least the first couple of these questions here, Forbes. What about traffic safety, Matt Simon?
Well, traffic safety, it will be dealt with the way it's currently being dealt with. I mean, the questions seem to presume what will we do when people begin using cannabis after it becomes legal to buy in a store. And the fact is that people are already doing it. So it's illegal to drive while impaired. Vermont has beefed up its training for law enforcement, and there, to a lot of people's surprise, there was actually a decline in fatalities last year, the first full year the legalization was in effect. But yeah, you address it through public education, through training, through law enforcement, and the same with workplace issues. This doesn't legalize coming to work under the influence any more than it's legal to come to work drunk. Employers are allowed to have their own policies and have to deal with the fact that employees do use cannabis, alcohol, prescription drugs, illicit drugs already, and it's something they have to deal with.
Workplaces, what about people showing up stoned for work?
It's exactly as I just said.
Pretty much same answer, right?
Employers can have policies now, and the bill doesn't change their ability to have those policies or to enforce them.
Okay. And all right, let's go to, let's see, looks like Frank in, is it?
Wheelock.
Wheelock. Good morning, Frank.
Morning. I have a question. Is there any other motive or motivation, real motivation, other than monetary, to have it regulated?
Is there any real motivation? Matt, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the money has never even been in my top five list of reasons to regulate cannabis. To the extent that I care about money, it's the fact that people are handing billions of dollars over to an illicit market. And
actually, you know what, Matt? I hate to do this, but I got to go. I really appreciate you calling in. We are about the bottom of the hour. We're going to end this segment on the Dave Graham Show. Thank you so much, right. Matt Simon.
Not for the money, Dave. Thanks.
All righty. Marijuana Policy Project. And we're going to go to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
We are back. The Dave Graham Show continues on this Monday morning, February the 24th, 2020. Thanks for staying with us, folks. I apologize there for having to cut Matt Simon off. We got to the end of our segment, and he talked about money not being among the top five reasons that he supports legalization and commercial sales of marijuana in Vermont. I'm guessing that one of the other reasons, those top five, might have been this idea of personal freedom. We have a tradition in America called freedom, and it's interesting to me that that sometimes the government is urged to get larger. You know, I know our Republican conservative friends love to talk about limited government and not having the government inject itself into people's lives to the extent that it might sort of naturally have an urge to do. And I've always thought that having government agents in the form of police officers come into your house and grab your stash of marijuana and maybe arrest you and throw you in jail or charge you or whatever, maybe ran counter to that idea of limited government, small government, government staying out of the lives of people who are engaged in an activity which, I mean, yes, there's some harm sometimes. The question is, how do you balance that issue of personal freedom versus risk? And it's a pretty risky thing to go to jail. I know that. Now, I know also that not many marijuana users go to jail for using marijuana, but certainly historically that was the case. I remember Bill Bennett, the famous drug czar back during the Reagan administration, talking about how he would have, quote unquote, no moral compunction about beheading casual drug users. And that to me has always sort of stuck out as the extreme position on regulating drug use in the state of, in the state and in the nation, the United States. It's hard to know exactly where to draw the balance there, but I think that was an interesting discussion we had here on the Dave Graham Show for the last hour or so. Let's move on to a different topic now, and the topic would be healthcare in the state of Vermont. The prices of prescription drugs, the kinds you get legally ordered by your doctor, can you go to Canada and buy them? There are going to be a couple of public hearings tomorrow in the state of Vermont about that topic. They are actually urged on by the federal government. And to talk about those issues and others related to healthcare in the state, we are joined by a not infrequent guest on the Dave Graham Show. Mike Fisher is the healthcare advocate with Vermont Legal Aid. He joins us on the phone this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Dave, and good morning, everyone.
Thanks for joining me this morning. There are a couple of hearings upcoming, I saw, tomorrow evening related to the importation of drugs from Canada. And, Mike, what can you tell me about these, and are you hoping people will turn out in large numbers?
Yeah, I think whenever the administration holds a public hearing to hear what Vermonters are thinking about the affordability of one part of the healthcare system, or affordability or quality, or access, I think it's so important for Vermonters' stories to come forward, for them to hear the context that people bring to, you know, the theory of bringing in drugs from Canada means something different when you're living with the fear of being able to continue to afford your drugs so that you can continue to support your family and live and work.
And the Vermont Legal Aid Office of Healthcare Advocate, which is your office, are you expecting to have people there yourselves?
We have not exactly planned to show up ourselves. I think this sort of got sprung on us just in the last couple of days. And so I'm really thankful that you're taking a few minutes to highlight it. You know, a few details. Vermont has proposed a little bit of a different approach than some other states. Some other states are contemplating importing prescription drugs from Canada to support the public programs, the Medicaid program. Vermont is contemplating doing this in order to support the health insurance plans to bring down premiums and copays.
So are we contemplating then really more a matter of the state of Vermont buying pharmaceuticals in bulk from Canada for use in, say, Medicaid programs and others, or are we, is this more calling on individuals to head up to Montreal for the weekend and stop at a pharmacy when they're up there?
Well, of course, individuals do this today.
Mm-hmm.
People along the border. I'd be curious to hear from a listener if there are listeners up there who do this themselves. I've heard people to say that this is their regular practice, people who live along the border. And no, the answer is that the state is not contemplating this. My understanding is the state is not contemplating this for Medicaid. It is contemplating figuring out a way to open up the border for importation of prescription drugs, for our commercial healthcare plans.
And so these two hearings, I neglected to look up the exact times and places of them. I don't know if you have that data, Mike, but they're going to be tomorrow evening. I know one is scheduled in Burlington and the other in Montpelier. Do you know the facts and figures there, times and places?
Boy, I don't have it right in front of me. I apologize, Dave. Maybe we can get it up on the webpage.
Okay, I'm going to go to the Hive here and see if any of our listeners out there happen to have that immediately available. I'm Googling as furiously as we speak, but I so far have failed to come up with the exact times and places of those meetings. I know they're both scheduled on Tuesday. One, I believe it was sort of mid-late afternoon in Burlington, and then the other in tomorrow evening in Montpelier. I know that's at the Pavilion Auditorium, which is there on State Street, right near the State House, in the basement of the building where the governor and other executive branch agencies where their offices are, and so it's worth checking out if you can find me. And I will be working on this.
I'll just mention another detail, Dave.
Yep.
From taking a look at the concept paper that the administration submitted, the Vermont administration submitted to the federal government, they're contemplating a handful of millions of dollars in savings for Vermont consumers.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a broad range. 1 to 5 million is what their initial read was, and that they are fine-tuning that estimate.
This idea, I think, first came up probably 20 years ago or so, our junior senator, then Congressman Bernie Sanders, was one of the original architects of this idea of he would take busloads of Vermonters up to Canada, and they would go shopping for prescription drugs up there. And I remember them coming back and saying, we saved a lot of money on these expensive medications and so on. Now this idea appears to have been taken up by a Republican gubernatorial administration here in Vermont. What does that say about its, bipartisan appeal or whatever?
Well, I think, first off, you're right. We've been talking about this forever. But the legislature this past year passed a law saying that the administration had to pursue it. So while we've been talking about it for years and years, this current run, I believe, started there. And then since then, the Scott administration has been going through the steps to evaluate and to propose it. I think sort of the natural next question that everyone should be asking is, if this is going to go forward, how soon could it be in place? After all, there are people at this very moment standing at the pharmacy counter not knowing how they're going to be able to go home with their meds because of how high their out-of-pocket costs are. But it's hard to answer that question. I don't have any clarity as to, even if things go very smoothly in this application process with the federal government, how long it will take. I haven't gotten any clarity from listening to testimony about it.
Yeah,
it's weeks or months or years.
I know that part of the process here was that the federal government wanted the state to hold a couple of public hearings on this topic, and that's what the impetus for tomorrow's sessions appears to be. So, the wheels of I guess you might call it justice grind slowly, and here we go, another quarter turn or something maybe.
Can I just take a moment to talk about insulin?
Yes, you may.
So insulin is not on the list of possible drugs to be imported from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And insulin is, or maybe I should say diabetes-related medicines, are one of those places where, wow, making sure people get treatment saves a great deal of money and avoids a whole lot of just horrible, bad outcomes. And insulin is one of those places where people are... we hear stories regularly of people not being able to afford their insulin, their treatment, and spacing out their doses, which is very much against medical advice. So we sort of come to this place of, what do we do about it? This is a now problem. This is not a, while I applaud efforts that may pan out in years to come, what can we do now? And the legislature is contemplating a few different approaches. One of them is to limit the out-of-pocket costs for insulin, and the Senate Finance Committee has been actively discussing a bill that would say, hey, consumers shouldn't have to spend more than $100 a month on their diabetes medicines.
I've seen that bill, and where is that in the process? Has it got legs?
I believe it does have legs. I don't. There was sort of framing, final framing up of the bill on Friday afternoon. I don't believe they voted. The committee voted on it, but I think it's my sense is that the bill is moving. You know, there is another approach that myself and a few others have been promoting, and that's to say, hey, insulin treatment, diabetes treatment is so important. Let's limit the amount of money that hospitals can make when they purchase insulin and pass it on to consumers. So I put forward an idea that basically says, hey, you can't mark up more than 150% the costs to the consumer for diabetes treatment. And that's another conversation that's happening, and I think it has some real potential to reduce costs for consumers.
So the current practice in some places, hospitals are marking up insulin more than 150%?
Well, there is a sort of a highly technical program that makes certain drugs available to Vermont hospitals and hospitals around the country at drastically reduced prices. And the hospitals are highly dependent on the revenue from the price spread between what the federal government says they have to pay for it and what the commercial payer has to pay for it. And I make a suggestion very cautiously. We want our hospitals to remain economically solid. In a very, very narrow way, there are a few places where we just have to do something right now, and insulin or diabetes treatment crosses that mark for me.
Listeners out there, if you have a story you want to share with us about the difficulty in affording your insulin, just for one example of what's going on in the real world vis-a-vis healthcare in Vermont and elsewhere, please give us a call. Let us know what's been going on with you and what you're doing to try to deal with what these problems are. I mean, this story about insulin and the prices of insulin and so on. Mike, do you know, is there any justification for, I mean, is this stuff made from any materials that are rare or we think about the reasons prices for things get go up.
Thanks for the question. The idea of limiting copays to $100 is pushing costs off to ratepayers. And the idea I said of limiting the amount of revenue hospitals can make is taking some money away from hospitals. Neither of those get at the real cause of this, and that's greed. You know, this is the place where the pharmaceutical companies are producing a product that's been available for decades that maybe has some new formulations in order to have them last longer, but it's not a new technology, and the price increases for products like insulin, I believe, really come from a place of big pharma maximizing their profits, and that's I sure wish that I was before you with a state strategy of how to reduce that profit taking.
Yeah.
Something the federal government would really have to be engaged in.
You would think so, but whether that is happening anytime soon is another question. By the way, we began this segment a few minutes ago by talking about these upcoming public hearings on the reimportation of drugs from Canada back into the United States, and the fact that the Scott administration essentially had been asked by the federal government to hold a couple of public hearings and get testimony from people about why this is an important thing and why if folks believe it should happen, or I suppose you can show up there and say it shouldn't happen for some reason. You're welcome to, I'm sure, express those views as well. But I finally came up with misplaced, but have regained possession of the times and places of the two public hearings tomorrow. And one is, these are both February 25th, which is tomorrow, the Tuesday. And We've got one going from 1 to 3 p.m. in the afternoon, as I mentioned. That's going to be at the Vermont Department of Health, 108 Cherry Street in Burlington. And then it's in room 1A of the Vermont Department of Health, 108 Cherry Street in Burlington, 1 to 3 p.m. tomorrow. The later hearing is going to be in the evening in Montpelier, and that is at from 6 to 8 p.m. At the Pavilion Auditorium, 109 State Street in Montpelier. That is a corner very close to the State House, so easy to find in Montpelier. And if folks want to attend those public hearings, it was one of the reasons I decided to do this segment this morning's a little public service announcement. But if you don't know the times and places, it's less of a public service. So I'm glad I finally found those and am able to parlay them to our listeners out there. I know Mike likes to give out his 800 number, and if you folks out there have any questions or comments you want a healthcare advocate to hear, maybe having trouble getting access to the care you need out there, that's what this office is for. Mike, take it away.
So yeah, thank you, Dave. So the Healthcare Advocates Office is defined in state statute to be a resource for all Vermonters. There's no income eligibility. It's a resource available to you, and we field we're doing in the neighborhood of 300 cases a month of Vermonters who are calling us asking for help with any number of challenges, often people who are frustrated with a decision that the state made about eligibility for one program or another, or frustrations with Vermont Health Connect. I'm sure you've had listeners call in with that challenge over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Other kinds of access to care issues, including concerns or frustrations about health insurance contracts or access to actual care at the doctor's office.
And they can call an 800 number, correct?
Oh, thank you. 800-917-7787.
917-7787. That's the 800 number for the Office of Healthcare Advocate at Vermont Legal Aid. And again, it's there's no income guidelines or whatever. If you could be anybody in Vermont and have questions about or problems with accessing getting your insurance to cover certain procedures, whatever the case may be, give them a call and see if they can help out. I would gather that in many cases you can. Some cases you can't, but that's life, right?
Yeah, we give it the best shot we can. You're right. It is not uncommon that people call us with frustrations about something that just feels unfair about our healthcare system. And, my advocates spend a great deal of time researching and evaluating and coming up with any strategy we can to help you. And sometimes it feels unfair because it is unfair.
Yeah,
But there's also plenty of times when we can develop strategies and help figure out ways to make it work for you. So my advocates are creative. They do everything they can to make it work for you.
How many people work in your office?
Well, we have 7 lay advocates on the phone at the moment. They have a supervising attorney who advises them on how to do on the details.
Yep, got it. Okay. Let's go to a listener. We got Rich on the line from Starksboro. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Michael. I got a question about the Canadian drugs.
Yep.
It's related to safety and quality. As it is right now, if we buy a drug a prescription drug in the United States, it might be made in Pakistan or something like that. It's sort of unclear to me what happens if this Pakistani company isn't making pure stuff or they're doing something. How many layers of bureaucracy do they pay for the enforcers to travel over there to inspect their plant, all that stuff? Does that go to the taxpayers? Now we add another layer. We go through Pakistan to Canada, then the United States. What do you think about that?
Mike Fisher, tell us about that issue of drug safety.
So, again, the Scott administration provided a concept paper that they submitted to the feds, and that had a few different sections, one of them being safety. And, Dave, I can send you the link to it, and you can get it up on your webpage if anybody wants to go look at it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that these are the same medications, the same packaging that is available across the border here in Vermont, that the safety, that, you know, these are the very much the same FDA approved medications.
So there's really they're not packaged in Canada or anything. They're just part of the normal stream in this product, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding of it. And again, let me make this link available to people, because it's your question's a very important one, I want to make sure that people can take a look at the document themselves.
Okay, Rich in Starksboro, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you.
All righty. Mike Fisher, talk to me. We got a few minutes left here. Just wondering if you have any particular other legislative priorities that you're hoping that the lawmakers will get done this year before they finish up.
Oh, you know, there's 100 little details that we're focused on, but I think the most important one is a real concern I have for the marketplace, the pool of Vermonters who are in the small group, and whether insurance companies are engaged in a practice to sort that marketplace, to encourage healthy lives away from it in order to be able to get market share, have lower rates. And I think we see evidence of that. I think we see more and more small businesses moving towards self-funding. I have a real concern that is motivated by an interest of the insurance companies to get market share, and that the outcome of that is that the people left in the pool, all of the individuals and small groups that are not as healthy or are older, the rates will go up. And so, you know, this past year, Blue Cross's rates went up 12.4, I think the number was, 12.4%, and MVP's went up, I believe it was 10.1. And I have a real fear that we're going to see rate increases like that going forward.
That is, and that stuff shows up all across the board in when we talk about increasing costs for, say, local education, because obviously the teacher healthcare includes prescription drugs and et cetera. I mean, all of this stuff really ripples out in many directions that worthy of tracking when you can. So there you go.
Yeah, and so, and then let me just part with the, if you're listening and you think, boy, I have a nagging concern about my health insurance, or I have a nagging frustration about, you know, getting into the doctor or getting the kind of care that I think I need, feel free to give us a call. 800-917-7787.
Mike Fisher, healthcare advocate with Vermont Legal Aid, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, everyone.
That's going to about do it for the Dave Graham Show on this Monday morning, February 24th. And thank you so much for listening out there. We'll be back with another edition of our program tomorrow morning about 9:05. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. And we will wish you all an excellent afternoon, folks.